Que facci be? And welcome to Shift F1, a podcast about speedy race cars. That is Catalan.
Oh.
Which I don't think we've ever done on this show.
Oh, really?
For take care. It's a parting phrase.
Oh.
Because as we will get to, I think, later in the show, not sure if we're coming back here for a bit.
Yeah, because they're just going to leave Spain and Catalan's going to rocket itself into the solar system and be its own planet. They're done with Spain and Europe and the world. Goodbye, Catalonia.
And hello, listeners. I am Drew Scanlon. That is Danny O'Dwyer. How are you, Danny?
Great. I'm delighted to be here to talk, you know, as the only European political expert here. I'm really glad to share my insights with you two Yankee boys.
Speaking of Yankee boys, Robert Zachney, how are you, Rob?
Not too bad. Still high off an F1 race that was really exciting if you really like F1, I think is the way I put it.
F1 for F1 fans. I saw, it's not in the news, but Chase Carey had like some earnings call, and he's like, you know, for the new viewers, the series hasn't been that exciting. We started with four Mercedes 1-2s, so
yeah, on paper, I think fine. On paper, I feel like this season doesn't do the sort of the races justice, maybe. But this one kind of did. this was kind of what it was on paper, I feel like. But there were some interesting bits and bobs. I, for one, can't wait to talk about Romain Grosjean's alternative circuit guide.
Well, before we talk about the race, I did just want to update everyone on the ongoing saga of French beer.
Oh my God. Is it French beer? Monégasque beer? No, I guess
it's
it is.
It's in Nice,
French.
I think, is where Blue Coast Brewing is. If you're just joining us, by the way, if you are one of those people that Chase Carey was mentioning and just watched the Netflix documentary Drive to Survive and are joining us on this podcast, might we recommend listening to the preseason primer episode to really get going there? I've been meaning to like mention that in the top of the shows, because I think if you just jump in here, it'd be kind of tough. But the preseason primer episode is where we direct everybody if they're new, because that assumes no prior F1 knowledge. But also, I think the ongoing saga of Blue Coast Brewing also needs a lot of explanation. Long and the short of it is there's this brewery that some F1 drivers have a stake in, and we're not sure it really exists. But thanks to our patrons, we managed to purchase some beer and have it shipped to us. It is sitting right next to me.
No,
as we speak.
Wow. No.
Yes.
Oh my! Can we get visual confirmation?
It's a cardboard box.
Okay.
Hey, let me point it over there.
He's turning the camera. Oh my God! That's a. It's not the Newegg one. It's underneath.
No,
it.
Oh yeah, it's this one. It's right there. It says Shift F1 on the label.
That is sizable.
Oh my God! It's here.
Yeah. It's here. Yes. By the way, if anyone wants to import international beer, I highly recommend going through official channels. Like, go find an importer in your town and say, hey, please import this weird beer.
Yeah,
to do it like us.
I feel like you probably can't share a lot of what's happened beyond in the background on this, but suffice to say that Drew has done an incredible amount of work to get that beer here, as have some other people. So
I didn't break any laws. Let's just get that clear here.
Drew didn't, certainly.
Yeah, and neither did Blue Coast. So yeah, no problems here. Everything's fine.
So we're gonna do a taste test or something, and
we're gonna do a taste test. I'll do an unboxing or something for patrons. Yeah, so look forward to that.
Did you ever explain how much it costs, or like, do we ever? It costs a lot of money. Just thank you so much to the patrons.
I mean, we could it would not really be feasible without the patrons, but it was not exorbitant.
No,
it's more than I would want to spend for a joke, but divided between you know, all 500 something of our patrons, worth it.
Yeah. I for one cannot wait to taste Daniel Ricciardo's delicious sweat.
Is that how they make it?
It's like Picari sweat. It's Ricciardo sweat.
Well, from a brewery in Nice, France to a racetrack, in Barcelona, Catalunya. let's take it to practice, I guess.
Hmm.
Some things started in practice. Stroll went into the wall. A lot of people went off, kicked up a lot of gravel.
A taste of things to come.
Yeah, I guess not that much happened in practice, but qualifying, more people going off. Hulkenberg locked it up and went into a wall and knocked his front wing loose. Managed to limp back to the pits for a replacement, but they replaced it with a different spec of a front wing, which is, according to the rules, illegal.
Yeah.
Quote, the aerodynamic setup of the front wing may be adjusted using existing parts, but no parts may be added, removed, or replaced. So he ended up going back out and qualifying 16th, but got knocked down due to a penalty for changing specs
stuff,
on the front wing.
Like, no? I hate the, like, pile onto a team type penalty that, like, comes into play. Like, do we really think there is a risk of teams being like, damn, this front wing isn't very good. I'm going to snap it off intentionally and replace it with the spec of wing I want. And then the F1 rules, if not for them, like, qualifying would just be rife with this behavior. And so to discourage it, somebody who breaks their car in a racing mishap, which already has kind of a pet, like, you lose your wing, you probably have more compromised qualifying, to then be like, and we're going to ding you 3 places penalty, just drives me up the wall a little bit. You know what I mean? It's very much of a piece with sort of the overall structure of F1 rules, which is when things go wrong, there's usually an F1 rule there to make it worse. And teams for whom things go smoothly are rewarded.
When it rains, it pours.
Mm.
Yes, it is raining for Nico Hülkenberg. He'll be starting from the pits. His teammate Ricardo barely squeaked by into Q2. By the way, we have Franz Tost, the team principal for Toro Rosso, with the Sky team for the weekend. Like, every weekend they call into like a different team principal and chat with them during qualifying in the race. I hadn't heard Tost speak much, but he seems like kind of a cool guy.
Tost is kind of a weird guy. It's interesting because he's not how I imagine him either.
No.
He's
got a real dry humor.
Yeah, a very like sort of soft-spoken, clipped delivery. And I think what you would not get from that is a sense of what a maniac he is for Formula One racing. This is a guy who, before the season started, when they're talking about continuing to expand the calendar, and pretty much everyone up and down the grid says, like, yeah, the season is long enough. Like, we really can't handle too much more racing. Tost's response to that was to say, any time you're not racing is time you're not living, or something like that, or is time you are wasting your life. And so the weird thing is, like, for all that sort of like soft-spoken, quiet, bookish demeanor in those interviews, what you have to remember is that internally this guy is like cackling with glee and just wants a never-ending F1 season. What everyone else would imagine is like hell for unvirtuous like F1 drivers and team principals, where it's like, you know, the season never ends. You're always developing. You're always flying to races. Toss is probably the only guy on the grid who'd be like, hell yeah, let's do that.
maybe Frank Williams. I think the guy that still sleeps at the factory.
Oh man, speaking
those
of
those guys, could probably have a brew.
And yet I think Claire might have had her fill. You see the shot of when Kubica crossed with a what's the time here? North of a minute 21 in Q1. Just the longest suffering sigh from her as she watched the monitors.
Oh, really?
It's just, yeah, I can't imagine how tough it is being on that team at this point. But the fact there's no relief in sight, This is just what you have to do every couple weeks.
Did you see Jensen talking to him on the grid.
No.
They had a... I guess I didn't see it because they play the audio from the Sky feed on F1 TV, but you don't actually see... You just get the whatever, the international feed. But I heard Button talking to Kubica, who he hadn't seen in years, actually. So they had Jensen on the grid walk with Martin Brundle. And you could just hear it in Kubica's voice where he was like, his response of like, you know, how are things going was very much the company line of, you know, we're going to try and take it one step at a time and fix this. And then hopefully after, you know, this season progresses, we'll see such and such. But you can just like, I feel like every time they talk to him, like as the season goes on, soon enough we're going to be talking about next season of Williams. You know, they're so bad, they're so off the face. It's just, you know, it's like the, what was it, the 105% rule or whatever, like
107, yeah,
7% rule. I feel we're almost getting into that territory. I mean, there was a lot of overtaking of backmarkers at Catalonia, and there always is, but the speed at which Hamilton, or, you know, sorry, spoilers, the speed at which people who were in the front at the start of the race were catching the backmarkers was pretty shocking.
Well, let's finish out qualifying here. Leclerc went over a big curve at turn 9 during Q2 and lost some underbody bits. They managed to fix them up pretty good. What? Gross. Underbody bits?
That's gross, man. It's a family podcast.
Somebody signs?
Sorry, I was just going to say, somebody reached out on Twitter and said that we, and particularly me, probably been guilty of overrating Leclerc thus far in his career.
Interesting.
And we tend to overlook all the mistakes he does tend to make, that he tends to screw up his tires early, things like that. And I thought about that as I watched Leclerc just smash that curb. and, you know, again, it can happen to anyone, but it, you know, it is worth noting that, like, when Leclerc is on, he looks so freaking good, and Vettel can seem so uninvolved. But also, like, it does sort of seem like Leclerc gets carried away. You know, he gets a little bit too into the moment, tries to push it a little too hard in a way that maybe more seasoned drivers don't.
Yeah, you could probably chalk that up to experience, maybe. But, like, again, we'll have to see. I mean, this is the first year we've seen him in a Ferrari, you know, and this is the second year that we've really seen him do much of anything. I guess
more research is required.
Watched him in Formula 2. But yeah, I think that's a fair point. But we're kind of learning him a little more now. Sainz is on good lap, but dipped it into the gravel and qualified 13th for his home Grand Prix. Although he will move up one spot with some penalties. Ricardo barely squeaked by into Q3. So yeah. Danny Rick making that Renault work in Q3.
Did he kick out Hülkenberg actually in doing that, or was Hülkenberg already resigned too? Because he was right on the edge there.
Hülkenberg went out in Q1. He was
Q3. You're saying sorry.
Also, with people on and off the track in this qualifying, you start to see rocks piling up on the track a little bit.
Yeah,
was the gravel always this rock shaped?
It's big.
I was stunned. I was like, I would be nervous driving over that in a road car.
Yeah, totally.
Like, I always view it like, you know, often it's called like, they're in the kitty litter. And that sort of conjures to mind, like, small, like, gravel-like, it's crushed rocks.
Yeah.
And what I was seeing all weekend long at Catalunya is just like, you know, basically pieces of brick just lying on track there after somebody had off and on. And I am wondering, like, is that standard now for what the gravel traps look like? Or does Catalunya just... Did somebody just go down to, like you know...
A quarry?
Home Depot. Garden center or something? And just be like, look, I need some rocks.
Yeah, I got a big fishbowl I need to, like, fill the bottom of.
There was a lot of it. And a lot of yellow flags, I think, one of which contributed to this weird thing with Hamilton... Mm-hmm. Where he had to abort his final run in Q2 because of some yellow flags. This is from racefans.net. Because of this, he was unable to charge his battery backup, and teams are not allowed to charge them in the pits. As we know, they charge with kinetic energy and heat from the engine. This meant that he needed to charge his battery on his outlap at the start of Q3, but the cars need to be driven quickly to charge the battery, and Hamilton had the conflicting need to back off to prevent the soft tires from overheating. Right up until the end of his outlap, his race engineer was urging him to back off. Hamilton, therefore, wasn't able to charge his battery fully, and his first lap was considerably slower than Bottas's by 0.6 seconds, which is a lot. By the time he came to do his second lap, the track conditions had worsened considerably. As Toto Wolff explained, quote, it could have been either track temperature or a lot of dirt. You can see that in one of the corners there was massive gravel, and you saw the last sector was really down for everybody. And that's right, no one improved really on their second run in Q3. Bottas, I think, set a lap record. Hamilton couldn't touch it. 0.6 of a second off of his teammate. Leclerc had a different strategy due to his floor damage. They actually fueled him for two hot laps rather than having him come in between. He ended up going fifth fastest, but those laps from Hamilton are maybe the worst I've ever seen. He just did not look on top of his car at all, but I guess that's because of this weird battery problem. Third pole position in a row for Valtteri Bottas. In third place, Sebastian Vettel. Fourth place, Max Verstappen. And fifth, Charles Leclerc. Behind them, we got Gasly, Grosjean, Magnussen on row, both Haas boys on row four. Danny Kvyat in ninth, and Lando Norris rounding out the top 10. Then we've got Alexander Albon, Carlos Sainz Jr., Ricardo, Raikkonen, Perez, Stroll, Kubica, Antonio Giovinazzi with a five-place grid penalty for a gearbox change. George Russell, same penalty for a gearbox change. And Nico Hülkenberg starting from the pits because he got that illegal wing. Okay. All eyes on Ferrari for the start of the Spanish Grand Prix. Danny, you want to take us through it?
Sure. Lights out, watching the two Mercedes in the front, and already you can see that Hamilton's got a bit more bite on the track, and he sort of ekes past Bottas. Kind of wasn't too much of a battle of it going into that first turn.
Between those two guys?
Yeah.
Did you see Bottas's quote after the race?
Mm-mm.
He says, there was some strange behavior on the clutch. It was biting, releasing, biting, releasing, which I've never felt before, so I lost it.
Yeah. I heard him say he had complained about the clutch, but I wasn't sure if that was human error or there was a mechanical issue, but I guess he's putting it down to a mechanical issue. I wonder how that affected him throughout the race, or was it just an issue of getting it, you know?
I think that's the only time they use the clutch, I think.
Surely not, is it?
I think the clutch, I'm not sure, like, I thought the clutch was working as part of the sequential gearbox. So, like, there's no clutch pedal. The clutch is the back of the steering wheel.
There's a paddle.
Yeah.
Like, it's a separate clutch paddle.
Yeah.
And then they've got the gear shift paddles.
Right. Is the clutch entirely automated? I don't know. I had assumed for ages, and then I heard then they all started talking about the clutch, and I was like, wait, so they're clutching in that? And I figured that they must be using it, but maybe they're not.
I'm under the impression that the clutch is only really to get going.
To get out of neutral.
And then when you're to get out of neutral. And then when you're changing gears, like down into a corner or something, you're just clicking paddles. Like, and that's it. It's just one click, and it's either down or up.
But what if you need to reverse in Baku?
Oh yeah, I should have mentioned that Ricardo also got a 3-place grid penalty for backing into Danny Kvyat. So that's Norris, Albon, and Sainz moved up position.
While Rob is looking into the clutch thing, I think I see him typing away on his computer there. Let me keep going with the rest of the first lap. So I guess Bottas's repositioning then creates an issue for Sebastian Vettel, who's trying to get in and around him. He brakes pretty hard on that first right-hander and flat spots his front right tire. That has a sort of a concertina effect where he then fills in the gap behind where Bottas was and gets in Leclerc's way. At this stage, it's Hamilton, Bottas, Vettel, but then Leclerc is suddenly under pressure from Pierre Gasly, who's behind him. Leclerc fights really, really well to retain the position, but then Gasly is suddenly under pressure from Kevin Magnussen, who almost gets side by side and looks like he has it. And then on turn five, which is that sweeping sort of downhill left-hander at the end of that whole first section, Gasly keeps that inside line, forces Magnussen to retreat a bit on that overtake, and keeps position, which is something that we see repeated almost the exact same later on in the race. But yeah, going up into sector two, it's Hamilton in front by a fairly healthy margin, with Bottas, Vettel, and Leclerc behind him.
Rob, you got an update?
Yeah, Drew's correct. It is the clutch comes into play when the car is at a standstill. So when you're basically in neutral, so neutral to first and neutral to reverse, you clutch into that. Beyond that, the sequential gearbox handles everything.
What I would like to know is that I believe on their like the warm-up lap, they're doing something to dial in the clutch bite point. Mm. I don't know what that actually is.
Have you ever driven manual?
I handful of times.
Right.
I've never owned a manual car.
Yeah, I drove manual only until I moved to America. So.
Sure.
I am. If you've ever, been stopped at a traffic light on a hill, you'll know what the bite point is.
But what are they doing to set the bite point? I don't know what that means.
It's probably like their differential, is it? It's the amount of pressure that they're putting on. Like they're just tweaking it slightly, like they do with the div on their turns and stuff.
Well, are you tweaking it or are you just finding it? You know what I mean? That's the question. Like, I don't think they are adjusting it necessarily.
Whenever I jumped from my dad's to my mom's car, because I never didn't own a car when I was living in Ireland, the bite points on those cars were different.
Yeah.
So like, I'm sure that there's like a variable in there that they can tweak a little bit.
Yeah. But I'd love to know why. Like, what? How can they do it on that warm up lap? And why does it change from race to race?
Yeah. And why don't they know before? Because they do their start practices in the pit lane all the time during practice.
Yeah.
So presumably they're testing for, you know,
shiftf1podcast@gmail.com.
Totally.
So Vettel earns that flat spot at the first turn, and by lap eight, Leclerc is all over him. But strangely, it takes another four laps for Ferrari to tell Vettel to let Leclerc by.
Well, it took them a while for the radio to come through with it. Charles is faster than you.
Yeah, well, I mean, he caught him at lap 8, and then lap 12 is when he gets let by. So, yeah. Meanwhile, Verstappen in third place is pulling away. And Vettel is complaining about tires for like 8 laps, asking every lap he goes by the pits, saying, do we have a gap? No. The gap, by the way, he's referring to if we pit now, will we come out in traffic or not?
Hmm.
So after the race, you had Vettel talking about he wants people, like he basically says everyone talking about team orders is making it hard for the team to make these calls. The fact that everything they do gets scrutinized and it gets read into sort of the team orders politics of Ferrari. You know, what he says exactly is, Charles was on a different strategy, and with the safety car, obviously his strategy is thrown to bits, but I think we tried to work together as much as we can, but obviously every time we try to do something, there's a lot of talk afterwards, which maybe doesn't help to be a bit more reactive on the fly. I get it. I think this is partly what athletes do when they feel there's an issue that the media is making worse, that like there is a level of scrutiny being applied to their team, and you go for a little bit of that us versus them mentality. But also, again, I kind of read this as how is this affecting you? Like, people are going to speculate about it, but it doesn't mean that people in Ferrari need to be worried about it. So I think the other way I sort of read these remarks is that some of the talk around priority and team orders and the way they shuffle Leclerc and Vettel around in races is getting in someone's head at Ferrari. Now, it's possible it's in, like, maybe Leclerc is in a little bit in his head about it because he sort of thinks, you know, he reads things as being a comment on him or where he stands in the organization when orders come through or when they don't. But again, it's hard for me not to feel this is also a little bit about Ferrari under Binotto right now. Which...
Totally, yeah. And I think a lot of it, even going back further, I just think when you think of team orders, you think about Ferrari. So I wonder how much of that just legacy that, you know, just still hangs over them. Actually, sorry, you did mention the Vettel thing, and it reminded me about, I actually completely breezed over the fact that Verstappen on that turn three, while I was getting very excited about Magnussen and Gasly, managed to get around Sebastian on turn three, which is why he was in third by the time they went into sector two.
Yes, and this is not the only point where we will talk about Ferrari team orders and strategy.
Yeah. But
Vettel does finally pit on lap 20. They put him onto mediums and really slow stop. I think the rear left had a problem, 4.4 seconds. He rejoins in 10th place behind Albon and ahead of Sainz. Verstappen pits to cover the undercut, which, by the way, means that potentially Vettel would be lapping faster on his new tires, so that when if Verstappen stayed out there too long, Vettel would make up time for him and he would lose that place to Vettel. So he pits immediately to kind of copy him, goes on to soft tires and rejoins in fifth. So already we're starting to see that Ferrari are splitting the tire strategies. Vettel has made this early stop. He's going for a two stop. He'll probably do a soft, medium, soft. And Leclerc is staying out there. So we're thinking he'll do a one stop. Red Bull is also splitting them. So Gasly, or they may not be doing two stop, one stop, but they're on different tires. So Gasly pits and goes on a medium tires, whereas Verstappen went on the soft ones. So interesting. Mm. Lap 25, great move from Kvyat on Kimi Raikkonen on the outside of turn four.
Yeah, which they credited, I think they credited this one to Alexander Albon originally.
Yeah, Albon, like, yeah. Oh, you know, Albon, he's a real exciting new kid. Oh, by the way, that's Kvyat. Kvyat's good too. We like Kvyat.
Yeah, Danny did some good racing this weekend. It wasn't his first overtake of the race, or his last overtake of the race.
No, certainly not. Watch this space. Lap 26, Leclerc makes his pit stop. But same thing happens. Slow stop, I think also 4.4 seconds. And he does go on to hard tires. So, yeah, one stop shop for him. He rejoins in fifth ahead of Vettel. As he was before. And after the race, Binotto explained that we had a, quote, cross-threaded left-hand side rear corner wheel nut on both pit stops. It's as simple as that. Yeah, simple as that. Cross-threaded left-hand side rear corner wheel nut.
Yeah, happened, yeah, both tires, both times. So presumably if it's the wheel nut, it's nothing to do with the gun. Or unless the gun isn't biting with... If he's saying it's a nuts problem, I don't know.
Nut problems. Too bad we don't name these episodes. Lap 30, Vettel is within DRS range to Leclerc. So Leclerc pitted later, but was a few seconds ahead of Vettel. But Vettel now is right behind him. So we're thinking, okay, he's caught up now. This would be a great time for Ferrari to... tell Leclerc to move over and let Vettel by the reverse. Yeah,
totally different strategies.
Yeah. Also, they're on completely different strategies. Mm. And they do that, but it takes six laps for them to do this.
Crazy. And then when they do it, it's in the weirdest spot.
Yes.
Like, what was that about? It was so strange. It was between turn four and five or something. It was
Rather than just doing it at the end of the straight. It makes no sense. Also, did you catch the part where DiResta... was hearing the offline radio transmissions that the two race engineers were giving their respective drivers. And he
that was amazing.
That so there's a miscommunication happening.
He characterizes it as chaos on the Ferrari radio.
Right. So Leclerc's engineers are like Leclerc's team is telling him you are on the same strategy as Vettel. Vettel's engineers, meanwhile, are saying they're on different strategies, and certainly in terms of tire selection, they're clearly on different strategies. So. There's this entire, like, shit show in the Ferrari pits as to what is happening. And because if Leclerc, there's a number of things here that I have a theory about how this happens. Let me give you my theory.
Let's hear it.
There we go.
Okay. So early on, they're both dealing with races that are compromised in one form or another. Vettel flat spots his tires. They have to pit him early and they put him on mediums and they're basically consigning themselves to a two stopper. which was, you know, probably inevitable for everyone, but certainly now we're guaranteed going to mediums this early. Those aren't going to last the race. So two-stop strategy. Leclerc, they're sort of trying to shoot the moon by putting him on hards. I don't know if the math on that strategy even works out at all. If you look at the lap times, he's generally running like 0.9 seconds off the pace of like the mediums on the Ferrari. So multiply that out over a stint. I'm not actually sure that saving yourself a pit stop with the hards performing that way necessarily ends up giving you time back efficiently.
Yeah, because we're working at like a 22 second pit delta here.
That's a 0.9 a lap, really.
Yeah, yeah, if you're missing almost a second a lap, then in 22 laps, you will have negated any advantage that you earned.
Right. So, like, I need to look at all, like, that is just me sort of guesstimating off of what I was sort of seeing with the individual lap times between Leclerc and Vettel, but it looks like the hard suffers pretty badly in comparison to the medium.
Softs, though, right? Or was it mediums?
Mediums, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So the hard's really not the optimal tire for the situation. But anyway, so they put him on hards, and they're saying this is the bargain we're making. He's going to go one stop through to the end, and that's going to be the efficient run for him. And then somewhere in there, my suspicion is the mediums are wearing much better than they expect. And Vettel's times are looking more competitive than they were expecting. And my suspicion is there's this moment, there is a moment where they're contemplating, shit, might we be able to get Seb to the end of this on the mediums? And at that point, a miscommunication is introduced. Team Vettel is certain they're on different strategies because they're on different tires, and possibly, like, it's possible it never even, this is why, like, I'm sort of speculating there's something that's never said publicly, that internally there's a minute there where they're contemplating, just leave Seb out there, see how far we can get on these on these mediums.
Yeah, and so right Seb's safety car at the right time as well.
Yeah, and so Seb's strategy is kind of a one stop maybe, which then does mean he's on the same pit stop strategy as Leclerc, but he's on a different tire strategy.
Yeah.
And so Leclerc's team overhears this and thinks, okay, well, he's on a one-stop or two, so we're racing against each other. You know, it's weapons-free, basically. Meanwhile, Vettel's over there on mediums, probably not very sanguine about the possibility of actually getting these tires through to the end. And anyway, you're still in the prime of life for the mediums. Let him through. Let him pass Leclerc.
Yeah.
And clearly what is missing here is somebody at the top saying, no, here's the game plan for both our cars for this entire race. And you end up with Team Leclerc thinking they're in a fight with Vettel, and Vettel being baffled as to why he's being held up and not attacking. And so that is my suspicion. My suspicion is that Ferrari, we're dealing with a dynamic situation. We're starting to flirt with an odd idea for Vettel's race strategy. And in that sort of fog of war, they end up playing a game of complete telephone with their drivers. Now, the thing that I do find weird here, I don't understand the hesitation to just get on the radio and tell Leclerc to move over for Vettel, and vice versa. Because here's the thing. Do we think Vettel cares about being third or fourth in the Drivers' Championship? Do you think that matters to him that much? Because I don't. I think for him, it's like, I'm not battling for a world title here. I don't think third or fourth makes a huge difference for him. I don't think he's racing for being Ferrari's number one driver. I think he's frustrated that he's not competitive with the front of the field. And yet, everything Ferrari seems to be tiptoeing around this, like, where do we set priority? How is this going to come across? And I think there's some situations where you have to be wary of that. But where you're dealing with guys with compromised tire strategies and a long race, I just don't see why you're not saying, let the guy on the softer tires move over. You'll take him in the pits later.
Yeah, it's funny, like we were talking earlier about how, you know, Ferrari or maybe Vettel are sensitive to the narrative that's playing out, you know, in the media, and might not be reflective of what's going on in the team. But like, what we've seen once again, that Ferrari was racing itself again this week, you know, and I can't, even with this sort of communication breakdown, it has to be embarrassing when, like, one of the biggest takeaways is that your engineers thought that you were on different strategies, when there's not even that much nuance in the idea of somebody staying ahead who's on a hard tire. Like, it's kind of like, it's a bit of a soft lob, that one.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's a shame. Like, I can empathize with the idea that perhaps we're like the Kvyat stuff, where we're sort of like, we're sensitive to this narrative and we're looking, you know, we sort of we're willing it into existence. But, like, it's happened again. Like, it was just at no stage, Vettel was supposed to be racing Verstappen, but it didn't feel like that again. It felt like Ferrari was sort of tripping over its own shoelaces a little bit, even just a little bit, but it still happened.
I've got a quote here from Matteo Bonotto, Ferrari team principal, from racefans.net. Quote, should we have done it earlier? I think by the time that you do it, you need to make sure that the driver behind has got faster pace. Otherwise, you are swapping and not having any result. It may take a few laps at first to assess that. On the other side, Charles was fighting for the third place with Verstappen because he was on a different strategy with the hard tires, a single pit stop. So it was as well important for him not to lose any lap time at that stage of the race. I think we simply waited for the right moment, and I'm not sure we should have done it earlier.
I'm sympathetic to that. Like, getting, like, that's a very engineer's answer, right? We needed a larger sample size.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we're not going to make snap judgments. On the other hand, the weird thing about, like, the prime of tire life is that that is kind of a snap judgment. Like, you can't, if you got guys running close for lap after lap, that's taking life out of the following driver. So I'm sympathetic to it. It's very hard to have confidence in that team with these calls when you have them sort of being publicly caught not knowing what their strategy is that they're feeding their drivers. I don't know. Did it feel like that second Vettel stop was also maybe forced a little bit by this whole situation?
Maybe. And just to kind of set the stage there, it is a little interesting at the front because Bottas and Hamilton pitted on lap 27 and 28 respectively and went on to the medium tires. And Bottas is told on the radio that the tire wear on his opening set was critical. So we're thinking that he'll have to either nurse them to the end or, you know, make another pit stop. So pitting would put him behind Verstappen at this point, who's also on medium tires and will also have to probably pit. Leclerc is on those hard tires, so, you know, anything could still happen here. And between that and Vettel pitting, Kvyat gets by Magnussen on the back straight, which is pretty cool. More points for Kvyat. But yeah, lap 41, Vettel pits again, puts on more mediums, much faster stop this time, gets out in sixth place just behind Gasly. Makes quick work of him down the inside at the hairpin, very clean. And then Verstappen gets a radio message. Leclerc's last lap was a 23.0, to which Verstappen says, no way he's going to the end. For comparison, Vettel at that point just did a 20.0. Verstappen also pits right after Vettel there again for medium tires and rejoins behind Leclerc, but ahead of Vettel. And we get a shot of Hamilton's rear right tire delaminating, which it looks bad. So we're thinking, all right, Mercedes, like Hamilton certainly, and probably Bottas too, will have to pit, but Leclerc is still on those hard tires. Lap 46, though, comes around, Bottas pits and comes out ahead of Leclerc, so I guess never mind about that. But then something happens that kind of throws everybody's plans for a loop.
Yeah, it was on turn two, right? Lando Norris into, well, I guess Stroll's ahead of him. Norris trying to get up the inside of turn two and just, you know, front right, rear left situation, pops Stroll into the air. They go diving and swimming into the pebbles, and then rather sort of confusingly, Norris, I don't really know why, but in an effort maybe to see if he could get it back, decides to drive across the racetrack and bring a, you know, a nice little flop of pebbles behind him, or stones, as I guess we're referring to them there.
Of boulders.
A dusting of boulders right in the middle of the driving line. Safety cars out anyway, obviously. We got two stricken cars on a very fast part of the circuit.
Yeah, I've got some quotes here from both drivers and the stewards. Stroll says, "I braked on the inside while he was on the outside, and then I had to turn in to make the left-hand corner. Unfortunately, there's not enough space for two cars, and there was not much I could do. I felt contact on my rear and was sent into the gravel." Norris says, "I was on the outside in turn one. He knew I was there. He defended into turn one. After that, I don't know if he saw me going into turn two, but I was still on the inside of turn two, and he just turned in. Didn't leave me enough space, basically. And he kind of pushed the front of my car and put himself out of the race and me out of the race as well." The
racing
stewards, however,
incident.
Say, it's from racefans.net, always referring to themselves in the third person. "The stewards believe that the driver of car four, which is Norris, could have backed out of the attempted overtake into turn two, and also that the driver of car 18, which is Stroll, might have been more aware of the possibility that car four could be on his inside. Accordingly, we believe that neither driver was, quote, wholly or predominantly to blame."
Yep.
Brundle called in immediately. He says, "I'm going with a racing incident on that one."
I'm with him. I think the turn one, turn two dynamic really defangs that entire straight as an overtaking possibility, right? Like, unless you have a commanding power advantage down that straight, it just seems the way turn one leads quickly into turn two and the way that racing line actually doesn't oscillate that much. You know, you take a pretty straight path through those two corners. It just feels like it completely makes actually passing on the back of that straight basically impossible. And I don't know how you solve that except by either changing the layout of the corners themselves, or do you have to give extra guidance to drivers where if you are contesting the corner, if somebody is trying to execute an overtake maneuver in turn one, you then have to commit to, if you're taking the inside line in turn one, you have to commit to a generous outside line in turn two.
Yeah, I feel like the sharper version of that corner is the end of the star finish straight in Monza or something, where like if you get down the inside of turn one, then you have track position, you're going slow enough where you can put your car where it needs to be for the next one. But yeah, you're right. You can almost cut that first corner and kind of just head straight. And I mean, that's what we saw later on with how to defend that corner is to force, you know, Romain Grosjean to drive off the track and go around a bollard.
And you can always defend it that way and you'll never get called on it because it always looks reasonable. So I think the only way you make this a more overtaking friendly track is if you lay down some guidance where, if you force, if you've closed off the inside of turn one, then you are committed to following. Basically, it's like a two lane road through that complex.
I feel like adjudicate or put down rules for individual turns like that, though, right? Like that you need to change the layout of the track at that stage, which they can do as well. It's not impossible, but you know, it's kind of like, you know, it's a bit of a Singapore sling, that one, isn't it?
Yeah.
You can kind of just go straight through it if you want.
Or you do the IndyCar solution. You just shave those curbs down and say, hey, if you get forced off, just go racing.
Keep going.
Treat it like they treated Circuit of the Americas. Just go flying.
Yeah.
Totally. Because then imagine how that changes. Where like
turn three becomes like a lot of fun then, right?
Right. Norris gets like he has to abort. He has to go outside. He goes over tarmac, and they just go side by side in turn three. Now that's good racing.
I'm kind of like making light of it, but honestly, it's not a terrible idea because the ending of turn four practically doesn't exist, but where turn five is, the real battle is between three and five, where like you're having that outside battle up the hill. It's really difficult to overtake around the outside, but if you do it, you're in the perfect spot for the braking zone for turn five. But they never get to.
We saw that with Magnussen and Gasly.
Totally. But
they went side by side for like the first three turns and then duked it out in turn five. It was awesome.
But yeah, but once you're out of that pack mentality where you're trying to defend your position as well, and it's easier to just, you know, block off turn two when you're in a 1v1 situation, as it were. And that's kind of why we never saw that then again later on in the race, because the fight was ending, was beginning and ending on turn two, unless you go around the bollard, which artificially created that situation almost, but not that close, not close enough. I mean, we'll get to the Grosjean and Sainz one, which I think is probably the best example of it. But
yeah, so let's finish out.
Romain Grosjean gave us a lot of examples of it.
He certainly did. The safety car here. Normally, when you pit, you lose, I think it was like 22 seconds. But under the safety car, because everyone else is going slower, you only net lose 12 seconds. So Hamilton pits and rejoins in first place. Leclerc, by virtue of the safety car bunching everybody up and wiping out his advantage at the front, or I guess he was in third at this point, he then pits. Also, he would have lost out on his old and cold hard tires on the restart. He rejoins in fifth behind Vettel, who's behind Verstappen. Also, for those playing the F1 drinking game at home, take a drink for Hamilton saying the safety car is too slow. Also,
did you see how slow the safety car was in... There was a crash somewhere. Did you see this? Sorry, a bit of a jump.
The one
there
in IndyCar?
No, there was... It was. They were big cars. I don't know what series it was in. But the safety car was driving so slow that the two front runners crashed into each other. Yeah, like 3 or 4 days ago. Sorry, I should have put it in the notes. Yeah.
Toro Rosso tries a double stack and completely botches it. The tires are not ready.
Yeah,
and this allows Sainz to jump Albon into 10th place.
Yeah, fuck them both up. Yeah, actually, it wasn't even, you know, it wasn't even like the second person got the worst of it. It was they were both held up.
There's a shot of like one of the pit guys. He runs to the car with a tire, but he gets there and there's already four tires there. So he's just like looking around, and then Gaviria drives off and, oh, this is for Albon. Okay, here you go.
It was a Chinese touring car was that crash was in. Although I was watching another series. Was it in? It was the Indianapolis Grand Prix where a tire went loose in the pit lane. Did you see that?
No.
Yeah, it was all madness happening in all the rest of the races. A tire rolled across the pit lane as they were. I think it was a tire that had been taken off a car.
Wow. Okay.
Just got loose.
All right. Who wants to take us through the restart here?
God, I the only thing I can remember, I don't even have notes for the restart, because the only thing I can remember is...
Okay, I do.
Hamilton, I know, got away quick. There was a fight in the back, wasn't there? Was it Gasly or someone?
Yeah, so Hamilton got a good jump on everybody. Not a good restart by Leclerc. So Gasly, gets a run on him and goes for it on the outside of turn one. And right behind them, Magnussen is going for it on Grosjean on the inside of turn one. So Leclerc keeps his place, but Grosjean and Magnussen, as they're going around the corner, touch tires, and Grosjean has to take the escape route, as we mentioned, where you kind of cut across the turn, but you can't just jump right back on the track. You have to go around a bollard or a cone in American.
Which is safer, but also maybe the faster way to take that corner as well.
Probably. He keeps that. He doesn't lose positions to anybody else. Magnussen, though, has so much momentum, and Gasly lost momentum from his move on Leclerc, that Magnussen pulls up alongside Gasly, and they do this amazing wheel-to-wheel for a few corners until Gasly can edge him out on the inside of turn five.
Which is what happened on the first lap.
Right, yeah. Hmm. So Grosjean, on the next lap, or no, this is a few laps later, is looking to retake the place from Magnussen, pulls to the outside of turn one again, and has to take the escape road again. Same move. And I think this is in the onboard video, but Kevin's engineer comes over the radio and says something like, Günther Steiner has told us, everybody, just calm down. Just calm down. Magnussen's like, I'm calm. It's fine. Then, one lap later, Sainz goes to the inside of Grosjean at the same place, and for a third time, Grosjean has to take the escape road. This time,
second time in a row.
Yeah, in two laps. Then Sainz does get by one lap later with DRS.
And then I believe Danny Kvyat did. They didn't show it on camera, but I was looking at the ending of the race, the places, and Danny must have got past him too.
I think they show it on a replay, but Grosjean may have gotten damage after hitting, because like when you go, the thing is, when you take that escape road, there are curbs or there's speed bumps. So he's launched over those things three times. And that may have, I don't know, compromised him a little bit.
The first one definitely seemed to, he seemed a little compromised after that first off and on.
Yeah.
I don't know. It being Magnuson, it's easy to read this stuff as him being an extra car width wide. You know, very sharp elbows, that one.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's tough to me. Again, like the villain of the story is probably this first the turns one and two just make this so tough. At the same time, like, man, Magnuson did not give an inch, and that feels a little bit different when it's a teammate. But
yeah, look, you're sitting at a poker table with Magnuson and Grosjean, like, you know who's giving an inch and who's getting out of the way. Like, you kind of know the way that one's going to go down. And I think Magnuson probably knows the way that one's going to go down as well. So he's happy putting the car where he needs to. It's a shame for Grosjean because he raced well. I mean, Haas, fantastic qualifying as well, but just a shame that he got gobbled up so much at the end of that race.
Yeah, he comes under pressure from Albon, who's in 11th, trying to overtake Grosjean. Can't end up doing it in the end. So Grosjean holds on to that last points-paying position. Kvyat, my driver of the day. But Mercedes finish 1-2. Hamilton on top, followed by Bottas, followed by Max Verstappen. Also, that trophy looks like a soda. Did anybody else?
Oh, I didn't see the trophy.
Oh, the little, like, stylized Catalunya circuit trophy with the lettering in it?
Yeah, it looks like there's a straw just coming out of the top. I don't know what it's supposed to be, but...
Like an energy drink kind of soda?
Like a very wealthy energy drink. let's finish out the rest of the field here. Sebastian Vettel in fourth and Charles Leclerc coming in fifth place. Gasly right behind him, followed by Magnuson in seventh. Sainz, Kvyat, and Grosjean rounding out the top 10. Behind them, we've got Albon, Ricciardo, Hülkenberg, Raikkonen, Perez, Antonio Giovinazzi, George Russell, and Robert Kubica. Out of this race are Lance Stroll and Lando Norris.
Yeah, great job, Carlos Sainz, getting in eighth position. It was a nice little cheer from the fans there as well when he got past Roman Grosjean. Although I will say Catalonia looked like it didn't have as many people as it usually does. I usually see those stands pretty packed. It was a decent amount of seats in some of them.
Yeah, I wonder how much of that was for Fernando Alonso. Probably a fair bit.
Yeah, you never know.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, like, talking about post-race interview stuff with Hamilton.
Mm-hmm.
Or do you want to hit constructors?
We can talk about post-race. I'll do standings after.
Yeah. Just Hamilton talking about, he gives this quote, and I think it's really interesting because it kind of confirms what I've suspected this whole season. He says, "It's a great car, but we don't always get along. I'm glad we worked out our differences." And this has been, I think, like, I've felt all season, like, for some reason, Hamilton doesn't like the setup this year. This design of the car doesn't suit him. And he's still great. He's still a great driver, and it's still the best car on the circuit, but it doesn't fit him like a glove the way other Mercedes have, and then it is played completely into Valtteri's hands. And I think this is the other thing that's contributing to sort of Hamilton's tension here, which is that he's still in the best car, but just in terms of what his own comfort is with driving style, this isn't the most fun he's ever had driving a Mercedes, and now he's got a teammate who is having kind of a career year. And it was just interesting to see him sort of, like, admit that there's kind of a stylistic thing. It is a great car. It is not a great car for Lewis Hamilton. And I am still very curious to see how all this unfolds over the course of a season.
Yeah, there's a really good video I'll link in the show notes from Chain Bear, who talks about the fact that car setups are way trickier this year, mostly because of the fact that we've got a larger rear wing, and thus the front wing can't compensate as much, and the windows for dialing this stuff in are really narrow, and so the way that you attack corners has to line up with that. So I think Hamilton has a very aggressive turn in, I think is what the video was saying, and in order to make sure that all the downforce and stuff is working. You can't really do that because you'll either have oversteer or understeer. That's a video really, really worth watching.
Did you also see, so Bottas after the race was talking about his pace, because if you look at it from lap one, like Bottas once again just gets annihilated seemingly, right? Like Hamilton pulls away and just then opens up this huge lead. And we're used to seeing the car in front does generally open up. It's easier to lead in an F1 race than follow, but it's really striking the gap that opens up between them. And I think this is the frustrating thing about this year, maybe the setup. Valtteri was basically saying that he was just gapping Lewis and keeping pace with him the entire race, because the problem is, even 4 seconds back, you're still in dirty air. I think there's a question about this in the emails. But for Valtteri, he says, if you're inside of 4 seconds behind Lewis, who has perfectly clean air, if you're inside of 4 seconds, you can feel like the front end washing away from you. And that takes more life out of your tires. So if you're in the site, like if you didn't lead the race from the start, it actually behooves you to just drop back and just, basically take that L. And I think that was Valtteri's calculation. They're swapping races. This entire season for them, the Drivers' Championship, might hinge on whether Valtteri can figure out his starts. Because once that happens, even though the cars are really evenly matched, the particular aero qualities of these cars and these Mercedes means that Valtteri can't really catch up and undo the result of that first corner in these races, right? It's just, it's not a winning play. And so I think that was illuminating as well, this idea that, if you don't lead the race from the start in identical cars, your best play is just to be purely pragmatic, gap the leader, and drive in his, clean-ish air.
Mm.
Well, let's illuminate the driver standings, shall we? Lewis Hamilton on top with 112. Valtteri Bottas right behind with 105. Max Verstappen in third place with 66. Sebastian Vettel has 64. Charles Leclerc in fifth place with 57. Pierre Gasly, a good chunk behind with 21 points in sixth place. Behind him, Kevin Magnussen with 14. Perez and Raikkonen are tied at 13 for eighth place. Lando Norris in 10th place with 12. Carlos Sainz, his teammate, right behind with 10. Daniel Ricciardo and Nico Hülkenberg both have 6 points for 12th place. Lance Stroll has 4. Alexander Albon and Danny Kvyat, also teammates, also tied with 3 points for 15th place. Romain Grosjean in 17th with 1 point. Then we got Antonio Giovinazzi and the Williams, George Russell and Robert Kubica with 0 points.
Who got fastest lap?
Hammy.
What? Hamilton, okay.
Yeah. Constructors?
Oh, yeah, he was Jones in third, wasn't he? He was, because that was his first of the season, was it?
I think it was.
Yeah, I think Bottas had a chunk of them, and then the rest of them were going to everyone else.
Yeah.
Max got one.
Leclerc got one.
Yeah, Max got Baku, I think. Yeah, whatever.
Mercedes on top in the constructors with 217. Ferrari in second with 121. Red Bull's got 87. McLaren in fourth place with 22. Racing Point's got 17. Gene Haas and team have 15 points. Alfa Romeo with 13. Renault right behind with 12. Scuderia Toro Rosso has 6 points. And Williams with the shall we take it to the news?
News. Let's all go to Holland. Let's all go.
Danny, you want to unpack all the racetrack news that we have this week?
Confirmed things that are happening is Zandvoort is back. Zandvoort, will we call it the Dutch Grand Prix, the Holland Grand Prix, the Netherlandian Grand Prix? Outside of Amsterdam is back. I will be completely honest, I have done a lot of looking at this track on the internet because I'm not all that familiar with it.
There is a YouTube video on F1's YouTube channel that I will link in the show notes.
Yeah, they have a track guide up already. I also have a Zandvoort pronunciation guide, which has been very helpful in me trying to come to terms with this track. The one corner on it that looks sort of interesting, which I've heard some of the drivers refer to, I think it's Chevlak. It's kind of a Parabolica-esque right-hander, which kind of goes on forever. It's got a weird, it's kind of a strange turn. It almost has like a double apex on it.
This track's real turny.
It's very, it almost looks like a go-kart track or something. But I've also heard reservations, I know Rob will probably speak to this, I heard reservations that perhaps, you know, there wasn't that many places to overtake in F3. So in Formula One, it's maybe not, you know, if you know, we may be replacing Catalonia with this one, we're probably just getting maybe a slightly colder Catalonia, maybe.
Yeah, like, so I've raced this track a lot, but in sims around like touring car racing sims, right? And it's a great track for that stuff, but you're also driving cars that are considerably slower than F1 cars and have nowhere near the aero sensitivity. The other thing that's really kind of taking me back as I look at like photos of the track, it's not just the track layout itself that concerns me. It's the fact that one of the things that encourages overtaking is that there is room to make a mistake.
Yeah.
I look at this track, and I see a lot of places where you could maybe try a move, except if you get it wrong, it's day done. And that's day done at best, possibly like a real ugly shunt at worst. And I'm sure they will modernize it a little bit and maybe you know, make it, you know, even safer than it already is. But I just look at this track and I see a place that I it reminds me a little bit of Hungary, I guess, in terms of you know, how comfortable people will feel trying to execute overtakes on a track laid out this way. Because
yeah, or like a Suzuka or something, you know, where just the minute you go off, you're beached.
Yeah.
And that's it. I wonder if the lack of speed will help. I don't know. I've heard the atmosphere there is great. The drivers apparently love it, like as a place, and they've driven in it as younger men and you know, it'll be good crack. I feel like Catalonia is probably that way as well, though. It seems like there's a pretty good atmosphere around that.
Yeah, I mean, like, drivers like races for reasons that have nothing to do with the quality of racing there.
Yeah, for sure, totally, yeah.
And so, I think that's undeniably a part of it. I am sure
you
this,
could just
I'm sure this would be
over everything and have runoffs.
I mean, they're 30 minutes away from 420 all weekend long as well. It's Amsterdam's right there.
Yeah.
Just saying.
Also in track
do they
news,
drug test drivers?
I don't
they
know.
Do
what
actually.
The...
They do.
Do
three
they?
Times
for
a year,
what?
Apparently.
What's their policy, though?
3 times a year? I bet there's going to be fucking a lot of them happening.
Like, what happens when you test positive for some substances, right? That's the real, like, every sport tests for stuff. Do they give a shit if you test positive for something is the real question.
I cannot think of a drug. Okay, I cannot think of a recreational drug that would in any way help and wouldn't hinder you incredibly badly driving an F1 car. Like, could you imagine?
Well, yeah, like driving, like, yes, like operating under the influence, like, absolutely. Like, there's nothing that I can imagine would be you know, there, I don't think there's a performance enhancing drug for F1. Yeah. Like, I can see people convincing themselves cocaine would be like a performance enhancing drug, but like, no, it would not. but more, I mean, like, if a driver, has a cannabis-laced cookie, for instance, an edible, you know, a week and a half before a race. Who cares? Like, what is F1's policy on that?
Yeah, I don't know. According to Kimi Raikkonen, as long as you have more drunk days than you have hangover days, you're on top.
Did he say that?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Or it may have been party days, not drunk days. Anyway, okay. All right. Barcelona, as you alluded to, Danny, is not a done deal for next year. The president of the Circuit de Catalunya says there is a more than 90% chance the Spanish Grand Prix will return to the track in 2020, but take that with a grain of salt. I believe Chase Carey, Formula One CEO, is in this article. Yes, he told a Liberty Media investor call earlier this week that the sport has, quote, agreements in principle on 2 renewals and are actively engaged on 3 other renewals. However,
so
quote,
that would be, sorry, go on.
The math means that we will not be able to renew all our current races. So this sounds like another price point standoff.
Yeah, and the other ones in renewal are, so Silverstone's going to be up again. I think it's Hockenheimring. And what's the third one?
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah.
Maybe it's Brazil, because the third track in question this week is Interlagos. The Brazilian president, a Mr. Bolsonaro, claiming that Rio de Janeiro will host the Brazilian Grand Prix in 2020, to which the governor of Sao Paulo said, no. So I don't know. I don't know what's going on there. Rio has hosted the Brazilian Grand Prix in the past, twice at different locations, one of them in like the 30s and 40s, which I don't know if you guys saw. I had some old footage from a cloth map trip where we were driving around Rocina in the favelas of Rio, and my guide pointed out where the track used to be, and it's like it's in the middle of the favelas now. There weren't favelas then, but they have since sprung up in this like mountainous region. So that was really cool. I was glad I was able to go back and find that footage.
That's amazing. Yeah. The other one, it was Monza and Mexico City are also at a contract with Hockenheim, Barcelona, and Silverstone.
Huh. We got two new tracks next year.
They have broken ground in Vietnam. Yeah.
Yes, and Zandvoort now. So
one is newer than the other.
Yes. Continuing in the news, our very favorite, one of our favorite drink related stories of this year, Rich Energy. a court has ruled that Haas sponsor Rich Energy copied the logo from White Bikes.
I don't know how they could have come to this conclusion.
They look almost identical. Only difference is like, so there's 4 points on the White Bikes logo, but there's 6 on the Rich Energy one, because they've added just 2 little ones on the outside of their stag horns. But there's some really good quotes from this racefans.net article. Rob, are you looking at it?
No. I'm trying to find it on the page.
So Judge Melissa Clark found Rich Energy's Williams Story, who's the CEO, quote, fully involved in the design process and knowingly copied the logo. The judge also raised questions about Story's reliability as a witness. Quote, Mr. Story provided different and inconsistent accounts of the development of the Rich Energy logo, she wrote in her judgment. Quote, he often did not answer questions directly, preferring to make speeches about his vision for his business, or alternatively seeking to evade questions by speaking in generalities or in the third person plural. He only answered several questions when I intervened. She gave an example of Story, quote, stating in an impassioned fashion that he was, quote, not in the business of trying to create a world-class business by taking any inspiration from anybody else whatsoever. But his own written evidence was that his starting point when thinking about developing a logo was to carry out logo research on what other drinks companies were doing, and to carry out internet searches on stag head logos used by other companies.
This is the adult version of a child who has been caught copying their homework, where they're not willing to just dancing around the questions with these vague.
This is the equivalent of using Shift F7 is the thesaurus in Microsoft Word.
Yeah, totally. This is worse than that Bethesda RPG that got leaked last week.
Like, good design is expensive, sure, but also it's not that expensive to get a design. the wild part of this is they went to this length. Like, they basically were cool, I guess, with they would probably end up in court over something like this, rather than just like putting out a call to freelancers to be like, hey, create a logo for us. Here's a stag head. Figure something out. Like,
what can I tell you? My idea. As somebody who worked in graphic design and did this sort of horrific work and had to work with assholes, I bet Mr. Story found this logo, passed it off to whoever's on the design team, and just went like, just make it like that. I just think it's that. It's like, and they went and they made a bunch. They made like a 5-pager with all of these different versions. And he was like, no, I really like my idea, the one I gave you at the start, that one. And they eventually like got us to the point where it was practically the same thing. And he could feel like he had like creative buy-in in it. Went, yes, that's it. I see you've tweaked it. It's way better. And, you know, but they're probably knowingly that they were copying something, but just wanting to get the job done.
Maybe they were just hoping that it was legally distinct enough.
Well, the good thing is they only have to replace the logo on like 5 cans, right? Because they don't sell this anywhere.
Right. Although those cans right now are going to be collector's items.
Yeah, shit. Those OG ones. God. Well, we actually have an email. We'll get to that in emails.
Also in the news, the W Series is could link up with F1 in future seasons. I think they have been targeting that for a while, so says David Coulthard. But he is now claiming that, quote, we have had a conversation. They would like to see how it develops. Also in this article from Reuters, I was interested to learn that W Series Chief Executive Catherine Bond Muir said the governing FIA would consider at the end of the season whether to award license points and how many. Drivers need to have acquired at least 40 points, and winning a national F3 championship is currently worth 10. So I believe we mentioned in the past, to get to F1, you need a certain number of super license points, and this has not been decided yet. What W Series is worth. So,
well, that's the only thing stopping women from getting into F1. So yeah. once we suss this out,
problem solved.
Yep. Just we needed. You know what we needed was super license points to address the gender imbalance in F1.
And a couple quick ones here. Chase Carey says it'll probably take a year to get the bugs out of F1 TV. and so look forward to that. According to Sean Bratches from Formula One, Ferraris and Mercedes are likely to appear in the second season of Netflix's Drive to Survive.
Oh, there is a second season?
Yes, I believe they are filming it now. Yeah.
Cool. I hope they are.
I hope it never ends. Just every year we just get our little recap of like it's like NFL films. Weirdly Riefenstahl-esque.
I was about to say that I think Ferrari and Mercedes, like all I want is Ferrari and Mercedes in this season almost, because everything that's going on, I feel like I want to know what the hell is going on behind the scenes with this.
Ferrari certainly.
For sure.
So they said like the reason they weren't in the first season is basically they were both looking to see what the other one would do. And then once one was like, we're probably not doing this, the other said we're not doing this, and that was basically how it played out. But they didn't have any objection to doing it, except that they thought the other team was going to also not do it. I'm very glad to see they may be changing their policy on this. It's interesting because I think what's weird is the Amazon documentary with, Grand Prix Driver, where basically, like, the McLaren disaster documentary that they shot. Clearly, McLaren had no input on how they came across in that documentary. Those cameras caught a lot that you wouldn't necessarily want someone to catch of your organization. Drive to Survive has also been pretty unsparing, I think, in large measure. Like they can be pretty.
But they didn't twist anything, I don't feel like. I feel like they showed what happened.
Yeah.
And I think I would be, if I were Ferrari, the, you know, very conservative Italian company, I would probably wait to see how the first season went, to see if indeed, this was something that would either help us from a brand perspective or hurt us. So,
right.
I think it makes sense. I hope that they do say yes for the next season, because I think that'd be great.
I think so too, but I also think the minute you look like, you know, the minute they show the episode on this race where the engineers are giving conflicting data to the drivers and the entire thing looks like a Christopher Guest movie, that's when you pull the plug on this little experiment.
Yeah, I wonder if they're like, if they'd be demanding Final Cut or something. Ugh. All right.
Documentaries, eh? Who'd make them?
Yeah. Tough business. Fantasy standings. There's a link in the show notes. Oh, yeah. If you'd like to join our league, on top, alpha emojis. A lot of familiar names in here. These players have cracked the code, it seems. Maka F1 in second, followed by Shunted Tarantulas. Steering wheel, hey, give it to me, move, come on. The Hamiltons Break the System, Speed Beast, Mercedes All the Way, Dragon Ball GT, Fry or Die, and in 10th place, Scuderia Calio. I am in, let's see here, 465th. Sergio Perez, not really doing it for me in this last race, or Racing Point.
I haven't looked. This is like when I don't jump on the scales after I've had a long night out. I'll do it in 2 days' time. I'm not going to look at it this week. I'll do better next time. Monaco, you know, can't be. Monaco's easy. I'll just wait until qualifying's over and then pick my team then.
Well, in the meantime, then, should we take it to some emails?
Sure. ShiftF1podcast@gmail.com if you want to send in your emails, your questions, or your recommendations. And boy, oh boy, gentlemen, do we have a heaps of both of them right here. Let's start off with this one. I'll read this one out. This is from Fias. Slipstreaming versus Dirty Air. Hey, all. I was watching W Series, Compelling Race, great production, and they mentioned a couple of factors that I know well separately, but not how they interact, despite acting in the same moment. Slipstream is the idea of following another vehicle close enough to take advantage of their wake and experience much less air resistance, therefore reaching higher speeds. Dirty air is the idea that turbulent air behind the car is bad for the intake and leads to poor engine performance. Commentators regularly talk about one or the other, but don't these things both act at the same time? What is the net result? I'll say Fias's description of dirty air mightn't be exactly accurate, but either of you want to take this one up?
Yeah, sure.
Go for it, Rob.
I think it helps. Don't think of air as air. Think of it as a fluid, right? Like imagine it like a more viscous fluid. Imagine it like water or something. And how it would act pushing an F1 car through that. You get the slipstream effect if you're very, very close, right? Basically, you are following closely enough that the fluid can't reoccupy the space carved out. Can't fully reoccupy the space carved out by the other vehicle, or it's just there's so much energy in it that it's considerably less dense, and so the fluid is moving around so much that it therefore poses less resistance as you carve your way through it, because there's already so much dynamism in that system. You get that beneficial effect only when you're like pretty hot on the heels of somebody else. Now, ironically, that is also where you're going to most likely encounter issues with the air possibly being less optimal for your engine. Because if you're doing that, you are also then sucking up some of the exhaust-laced air from the car you're chasing. And so that does become an issue for engine performance. But when we're talking about dirty air, now imagine, you know, the second vehicle is following at a considerably greater distance. And this is kind of what Bottas was dealing with this race and why he sort of gapped Hamilton so aggressively. So you're following behind, and the other part of an F1 car design is that everything is designed, all the aerodynamic elements are designed to cut through perfectly like still air. The fluid is unperturbed and everything works beautifully because all those little planes and angles just carve through that fluid just as they were designed to in a testing environment. The problem is when you're following behind a leading vehicle and you're not in that slipstream range, what you've still got is a lot of fluid that is sort of moving around and shifting. These little vortices, there's whirls, and therefore none of it is striking the angle on the aerodynamics as cleanly as the aerodynamics were tuned to operate. And so you're not getting the slipstream effect from following closely in the wake, but you're also not getting the effect, the full effect of your aerodynamic elements. And so the car, especially these aerodynamically sensitive cars, performs considerably worse. And this is, and this effect is so, they, these things are so delicate. This is why even 4 seconds after Hamilton goes through a corner, Valtteri Bottas comes through it. He can still feel that the car doesn't have the same aerodynamic grip that it would in optimal conditions.
And I think mentioning corners is also an important part of it as well, because when, especially when it comes to dirty air, the sort of caustic effects, all those vortices that happen in dirty air, are far worse when you're traveling behind somebody close in corners, just because of the nature of the way in which the car is like cutting through that air, and the way in which it's changing even its trajectory throughout the corner means that it's just spewing out more and more of this air, which is, you know, messing with your downforce and with your aerodynamics. So that's why, like, you'll often see cars like strips, you can see slipstreaming all the time, right? There's a reason why cars always pull out at the last second when they're overtaking on a straight like that. It's because they're trying to get the most amount of acceleration between them and the car in front of them, so they can get up and around them. And then the issue you see sometimes is the cars that are quite close to them, after a couple of corner sections, they're like a hair off the other car. And that's kind of where DRS was thrown back into the equation, to try and close that gap a little bit where you're losing some seconds in the dirty air and going through some of the corner sections. But yeah, it's not one or the other, right? They kind of happen at the same time.
Well done. There are also some YouTube videos for this. Chain Bear and WTF1 both have slipstreaming awesome versus dirty air videos. I've only seen the Chain Bear one, but it's very good. I will link both of them in the show notes.
Cool. Drew, do you want to take the next question from Nick Kearney?
Sure. Hey, Drew, Danny, and Rob. I'm in Australia, so I only have access to races from 2018 and earlier on F1 TV. What is the archive like on F1 TV? Can I go back and watch all of Senna's races and see why people love him? How about watching the great Hunt v. Lauda rivalry? I'd really love to see Jim Clark's races also. Can I watch them? No.
No.
You can't watch the Hunt via... versus Lauda or Jim Clark, because those are pre-1981, and so yeah, far they've only uploaded races as old as 1981.
And even so, they don't have all of the full races. So, for instance, if you went into the, you know, Senna era, you know, late 80s, early 90s, what you'll see is that when you go in, they'll have a lot of these sort of highlight packages, which I guess were done and broadcast at the end of the season, that are like 27-minute long or 35-minute long videos. For like almost all of them, they have those, and then they'll have the full race for like a number of those in the races in the sort of 80s and 90s.
Yeah, it's a handful. So I'm looking at 92 right now. We've got Australia full race, Hungary, Germany, Britain, and Monaco. That's it.
Right. And then the rest is all, what do they call them? There's a weird title they give them.
1992 in review, South Africa.
That's it. Yeah, in review. So I think these were packages that whoever did in the postseason or something when they were looking back. Or maybe they did them maybe, you know, the Monday after the race or something. But yeah, it gets better the more modern you get. So if you get into the early aughties, you start to see like full seasons again.
Well, yeah. But even 2014, we've got Bahrain, Canada, Hungary, Abu Dhabi, and that's it. So it's scattershot.
They also autoplay with just the sound effects. No matter how often I use any one of my machines, I always have to go into the little thing and click the commentary track on. Always happens to me, and I'm like, oh, what's going on?
That's really weird.
Yeah, it does it live as well on F1 TV a lot of the times. So I'll just get
sound Give it a effects. Year, Danny.
Give it a year. Chase Carey's working on that CSS file real hard. We got a lot of emails about YouTube stuff. So let's get into it. Rob, do you want to read this first one from Xavier?
Sure. I was listening to the latest Shift F1 podcast, and you guys talked about YouTube channels and sources worth following to learn about F1. One channel that you guys did not mention is that of 2016 F1 world champion Nico Rosberg, who has a very popular YouTube channel and does race analysis for every practice, qualifying, and race in a weekend. His analyses are incredibly insightful considering who's recently racing for the team that is at the top. As a recent former F1 champion who is familiar and personally knows more than half of the drivers on the grid, he can give perspectives on the psychology of driving better than almost anyone out there. He also has a lot of access, travels to every race, and sometimes does his videos from the actual racetrack. He talks about cars, tires, engines, team dynamic strategy, and racing psychology with a crazy level of detail. I'm in. Give me that.
I remember when he launched this.
Yeah, he's been doing well.
And it was real vloggy to start out.
Yeah. He's up there, though. He's probably one of the top F1 racer influencers. He's got 507,000 subscribers almost at the moment.
I won F1 world title and retired?
Look at that crazy thumbnail.
Right? Somebody who's still an up-and-comer with only just shy of 7,000 subscribers is the next email, though, from Katie from the UK. Drew, do you want to read this one?
Hey, guys, not really a question, but as much as a neat discovery made on the F1 subreddit. Okay, let me read that again. Hey, guys, not really a question as much as a neat discovery made on the F1 subreddit, but Roman Grosjean has a YouTube channel with only 5,000 subscribers or so as of me writing this email, where he uploads little behind-the-scenes stuff from his training regimen to little snippets of his life on a race weekend and even occasionally race recaps. Thought this might be of interest, so thought it'd be best to pop it in an email in case you hadn't seen it already. I had not.
Yeah, and there's videos going back quite a while, and some of them only have like 300 views. So you can go back and check
Amazing.
That stuff out.
Okay, I'm gonna
his
like that
his
too.
More recent stuff seems to be doing better though. So, you know, you gotta put the hours in. You know,
yeah,
get that tip jar up, start streaming.
Wow, winter training season 1, 812 views.
I know.
That's he. Oh, Lake Geneva, 596 views.
He's an up-and-comer, man. Just give him a year. He'll be on that intellectual dark web photograph with all the rest of them.
Let's diagnose. Okay, he's got some drone footage. Decent typography here. I wonder if this is he is... Oh, vertical video. Okay, at least he's doing the thing where they take the vertical video and then they Gaussian blur the background and stretch it out so it gives a nice... background. I don't know. Sure.
We have some more YouTube recommendations here. This one from Nommers. Autosports YouTube channel, of course, is a great resource with very nice diagrams and photos of the tech in the technical videos, along with analyses from some very smart guys. They release very consistently. As far as I've seen, it's all quality stuff. Also, if you're willing to talk about other podcasts, Mist Apex has some really good tech stuff mixed into their race reviews and a separate tech breakdown episode every few weeks. And he adds at the end, as a fun fact, Danny's Escape from Mount Stupid video on F1 games got me into playing that got me into following F1. A few years later, I see some guy who got me started in F1 doing a podcast and started listening every week. Love the work, and I love the way the show has progressed over the past few years. Thanks so much. Sorry, give myself a pat on the back there, but it's very weird that somebody watched a video back then, because back then was when I was starting to get back into F1 as well. Because my friend Joe Barron, who works for Project Cars now, Slightly Mad Studios, crashed at my house and made me watch a couple of races. And I was like, oh, it's great now that Schumacher's not winning every race. And we got one more email from Kevin in Indianapolis. I tried to stay. We got a lot of Mission Winnow and Rich Energy emails. But Kevin's out there doing the good work. So I had to feature this one. Kevin says, while attending the IndyCar Grand Prix in Indianapolis this past weekend, I was alarmed to find that Rich Energy sponsors an Indy Lights team. Indy Lights is basically F2 for IndyCar. There was a large Rich Energy banner above their garage and a mini fridge full of energy drinks sitting on a table next to it. As an avid Shift F1 listener, I felt a responsibility to verify the authenticity of this energy drink, so I acquired one. I'm not particularly interested in drinking it, but let me know if you'd like me to send it to you. So this is really a question for Drew. Now that you've already done all the hard work to, you know, ship a liquid from France,
you must
how
be
do you
tired.
Feel? Yeah.
I could really use an energy drink. I will reply with the Shift F1 mailing address.
Dead drop. Liquid dead drop.
Yeah. You go into a park, drop the can by a bench, and then leave at 12:36, and I'll show up at 12:37 and sit at the same bench.
Perfect.
Shift F1. Not super clear on how the clutch works in F1, but damn, we're going to be the most virile F1 podcast on the web.
I think you just encapsulated it, Rob.
Yeah. I
think you nailed it. You can also follow us on Twitter at Shift F1 Podcast. I am at Drew Scanlon. Danny?
At Danny O'Dwyer.
And Rob?
At Rob Zachney.
Should we take it around the world, Danny?
I think we should probably race around the world.
Kicking off on Friday, we got Gander Mountain Trucks for the North Carolina Education Lottery. At Charlotte. Well,
that does not say much for North Carolina's education.
Yeah, if you're educating people about the lottery, no one would use the lottery. They're racing 200 miles. Also, cool. W Series and DTM are in Zoldner.
Ooh, very good.
Zoldner. Oh, there's no N there. It's just Zolder.
Yeah, I was wondering, is that a pronunciation thing?
No, it was a really old PC game that I played in high school. And that's in Belgium, cool. though, for both of their round twos on Saturday. MotoGP is in Autodromo Bugatti for the Grand Prix de France on Sunday. Motocross is in Portugal for the MXGP of Portugal. The NHRA is at the Virginia Motorsports Park for the Virginia Nationals.
Where's that? Motorsports Park. I wonder how close that is. Richmond, maybe?
You gonna look it up? You gonna go?
Yeah, sure am. I keep missing it on Dover. Virginia Motorsports Park is in North Dinwiddle. North Dinwiddie.
What did you call me?
North Dinwiddie, baby. It's south of Richmond. It's down there. We're getting into North Carolina country. Dinwiddle. North Dinwiddle.
Super. Well,
that's very far.
Formula is in Autopolis.
What? Excuse
me? Oh,
my
God. Take me there.
The great city of Autopolis, which is located in the Kamitsue village in Oita Prefecture.
Great prefecture.
Hita City, Japan. 30 kilometers northeast of Kumamoto.
Autopolis.
Too bad it's destined to be wiped out by the Decepticons.
And finally...
Oh, yeah?
We got NASCAR. And you know that we got it. NASCAR. We are at the Charlotte Motor Speedway along with them trucks for the All-Star Charlotte 2019.
All-Spark?
Yep. And the Auto Club 400? I don't really...
You can use the voice. That's okay.
I don't really know how this works, but I guess there's two races.
We haven't done our primer on NASCAR yet.
No, we haven't. That'd be a good one to do.
Yeah.
All right. That's what's going on in the world of racing. If you'd like to support the show, you can do so at patreon.com/shiftf1. Get access to all our weird bonus stuff, podcasts, video game videos, all that funness. We got this week... We are posting, I still have to edit, but we are posting the TT3D documentary, Closer to the Edge.
Which should be a poll going up as well in the next few days on the next F1 game history.
Fantastic. Mm. Catch us next week for pre-Monaco. Getting back Danny Rick's favorite place. What?
it's not the Monaco voice. Jeez, use the NASCAR voice for Monaco. It's the least NASCAR thing there is.
Check out this yacht I got.
Hey,
there was all this champagne here, but I replaced it with Miller High Life. So,
hop on board.
I'd love to see the NASCAR contingent at Monaco.
I'm sure it's there.
Hats and, yeah,
it's there. All right, that's all I got. Anything else, Danny?
No, looking forward to another procession in Monaco. Beautiful, it's the most beautiful procession of the year. Let's do it.
Save your cynicism for next week. Rob Zachney.
No, I'm with Danny. I can't even feign enthusiasm for Monaco.
Great, well, you'll have that to look forward to. Have a good race weekend, everyone. We will see you all next week.
Yeah.